Welcome to the Leaders Playlist. You're with Renee Craven and David Clifford. Today we're exploring the leadership skill of teaching with Dan Levy. Dan's the principal of More Space for Light, specializing in corporate innovation and strategy.
Dan, welcome. And hello. Can you tell us the story of Dan?
Where would you like me to start with the story of Dan, Dave? Because
I would say start at the beginning, but we could be a long time here. Just let's summarize the last 5 years for us. What's happened for Dan in the last 5 years?
Summarize the last 5 years. You've done your homework. So in the last 5 years, I have started a company called More Space for Light. I've also become a father to a second child. I've also coping through a pandemic and currently in a lockdown. So trying to keep and sustain a business that I love and I just enjoy doing. My latest career as a business owner started 5.5 years ago when we started More Space for Light. And the whole reason we started More Space for Light was because we saw a gap where we were anyway in South Australia, where there was a gap between a company wanting or needing something and going out and getting a supplier in, and that supplier just going off and doing whatever they felt was right and there being no connection. And we saw there an opportunity in that middle ground to connect strategy and execution. It was kind of a grey area. What I've learned in terms of as I've kept the business, like evolved the business and grown into the business, or More Space has grown, is that our world has shifted away from execution. I come from a world of execution, being a designer and being in UX, and gone more towards strategy and facilitation. And now our work is just pure strategy and facilitation. About 90% of our work is facilitation.
Oh, can you tell us a bit more about the name? It's an unusual name. How did you come up with that?
Okay, so the name. So everybody, I think, gets to a point in their career where they kind of start to wonder. They start to wonder, what would life be like if I did something for myself? And they kind of, I mean, I'll ask you a question. Do you ever feel like you always wonder what the grass is like on the other side?
Every day, Dan. Every day.
Every day. So, same colour.
It's a recurring team.
That's the joke.
It's a recurring team. That's right.
Well, it's the punchline. It's the same colour. But I guess I was going through a period in my life where I'd always wanted to do something for myself, and I always wanted to take that opportunity to back myself. And at that time, my mindset, like I didn't really have an idea of what it was like to run a business. So this is the first business I've ever run. I was a freelancer, but that I don't really count that. And I knew I wanted to do it, but I just didn't have the courage. I was trying to pick up signals and signs and that. Anyway, one night I was putting my little boy to bed, and I used to work a lot. I still do, because I'll be working tonight when you're recording this. And there was a couple of other circumstances where I was working at the time. And I was putting my little boy to bed one night, and he said, "Daddy, I want more space for light." And I turned around to Mum, my wife, and I said, what does that mean? And she explained to me, it basically for him, it meant he didn't want to go to bed yet. He wanted more time to play. He wanted more time to read. And that just blew my mind. Not just that, my designer brain went, oh my God, I've got a brand. It sounds nice. It comes off the tongue. And also, like, I totally bought into it. So it was almost like we had a vision, we had a mission. And I had something I could get behind, because I wanted more space for light in what I did. And I knew from my experience in the career, in my career, that also people that seek help from consultants and from service providers, they need more light as well. You know, they let go of things and they don't know what's coming back. They sometimes they need that help. And that was where I saw our position as that guide. So if you know the Joseph Campbell's the story, you know, this we were the guide. We were the Gandalf.
Nice. That's a nice story, Dan.
I tell you what, Renee, I've sat in a car some nights coming home or on the bike, and I've got like left hand turn, there's some conference or some, you know, business thing, right hand turn, go home, have dinner with the kids. And I'll just stand there and I'll be like, all right, what am I going to do? And I'll just say to myself the four words, more space for light, the mantra. And it's like my compass straight back home. You know, it's a real kind of nice North Star. And it's just kept me honest, kept me true to the values that we started the company with.
Nice.
Very cool. So the topic of our conversation tonight is teaching. What does teaching mean to you, Dan? How would you define it if you had to define it?
Gosh, this is such a crazy question at the moment, because not only am I seeing myself a position as a facilitator, as a teacher, but also as a parent in lockdown as a teacher. and I find my ability as a teacher quite questionable, as I'm easily distracted with YouTube wormholes with my kids, because I find it far more stimulating than helping them with their maths assignments or anything like that. But we all go back to the teachers that have helped us accomplish things and it's helped us really fall in love with subjects, and they've never stood in our way and they never tried to slam it down our throats. And I think someone that acts and serves as a teacher is someone that is a guide, and it's their role and their position as a teacher to present information and stories or whatever it might be, the data, in a method with their user, with their client, with their customer at their heart. And that is my role as a teacher, is as a conduit to connect the dots almost.
Tell us a story of that one teacher at school that teacher for you, changed it for you. Do you have one? Because I don't.
You don't really?
No.
How about yourself, Dave? Do you have a teacher that changed things for you?
I was just trying to think about that. I'm still back on the trying to school kids at home during the lockdown, which is, my respect for teachers has grown immensely over the last 18 months. I got to give it to them. I don't know how to do it. I was a terror to my teachers a bit in school, a little. kind of always thought I was a bit smarter than them. I'm sure, yeah. Like, I had one or two good teachers, an English teacher that was really good. I think we all know, right? We've seen teachers that just go through the lessons. It's teaching by numbers kind of way. There's no passion. There's that. And then when you meet a teacher with actual passion in the subject that they're teaching, you can't help but be, you know, go along the journey with them and, you know, get enthusiastic about it. I can't remember the names now. That's a whole thing. School is a long, long time ago. But it was definitely an English teacher. Just got a passion back into reading. And maths was another thing for me. And yeah, but it's you know, by the way they do it. They live it, right? They just don't. It's not a job for them. It's a vocation, isn't it? Do you agree, Renee? What do you think?
I did have one science teacher in high school who was passionate. Very, very, very passionate. And he would do things like teach us how to grow marijuana in our classes. So he was a little bit distracted from what he was supposed to be teaching, but he was very passionate about those sorts of things.
I've had a few. I had Mr. White, whose nickname was Chalky, was our geography teacher. And we'd learned nothing about geography, but I learned all about ambient music and Pink Floyd and where to go out in London to listen to hippie stuff. And then, I mean, there was Mr. Eames, English literature teacher, Mr. Golding, that taught me how to cut film in media. But I think I'd have to really credit my university lecturers, Chris Speed, I think Dan Livingstone, and Mike, I can't remember his surname. They were incredible. So I I did a subject called Media Lab Arts at university, which was kind of like Lingo and Director and Flash and all that web stuff, and kind of fusing art history and the principles of art with digital technology. So it was pretty cutting edge at the time. And those guys, like, so I was always into art, the theory of art, but these guys just like knitted it all together, and their passion for what they do, they still do it now, I'm still connected with them, it's just incredible. And that really inspired me, and inspired me in terms of what I wanted to do in my career as a digital designer back 20 something years ago. Gosh, more than.
So how did you learn to become a teacher yourself?
It's interesting because, like, I kind of feel uncomfortable with the position of teacher because, like, I this is going to mess up the questions, but I never really kind of see myself as, I never kind of stop and regard myself as a teacher because some people would say that as a facilitator, you're not a teacher, you're a guide. But there are occasions where you are teaching, you're taking people for a method or a framework, or you're trying to help them adopt your framework. But when you're doing that, because you're doing it every day, you kind of, you don't think it, you don't force it. As a teacher, I kind of always associate the word teacher with father or parent, because you're just constantly helping and guiding your kids, because that's like 24/7. And also, you're learning about yourself as a human being, your patience, your tolerance. Because really, teaching is about patience, isn't it? At the end of the day, it's about patience. Because people that have got short tempers, because I had a teacher that had like a fuse that you could do anything, and it would be, there would 0 to 100, you just react. And they can't teach you anything, but it's all about patience. It's all about listening. So I feel like the question was, how do you think you keep growing as a teacher? I don't think that ever ends. I don't know when that starts. Does that sound too existential? It's like,
I think you've got a point. I think, yeah, I get what you're thinking. It's hard to define it. Like, when you talk about coaching and talking about mentoring and teaching, and I think it helps you. For me, as a teacher person, it helps you grow as yourself, right? And if you go through the journey of higher education and all that, rather than the very directive teachers you get from primary, where it's, you know, 2 and 2 is 4, and that's the only correct answer.
They're babysitting you.
They're babysitting, hand-holding. And then as you go further and further along, they step back, right? They're giving you the space to grow, right? And they're not being directive. They maybe challenge you a little bit. And do you find that you kind of fit into that mold? With some clients, you're a lecturer as well, aren't you? You've been doing some lectures at unis. And so you find out that day to day with your clients, you're very much, this is how you do the framework. This is like the solution to the problem. Yeah. But when you step back and you're lecturing and, you know, you're being asked questions, do you throw questions back at those students to say, maybe challenge them a little bit about their thought process and how they see things?
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me just think. I guess our approach is to always challenge, because if you're not challenging, it means that you're not testing people. And I don't mean that in an aggressive sense. I mean, even with our clients, we've got a relationship with them where we can push back and there is friction. And I guess our goal is to help people understand and use the tools of human-centered design. So in that respect, I guess we are trying, that is our role as a teacher and as a guide. So that is our goal, to basically enable the capabilities of organizations with the tools of human-centered design. But in the day-to-day of what we do, because I'm constantly facilitating, constantly in front of people, constantly giving them tools and frameworks and helping them understand and adapt and adopt them, that I don't ever think of myself or regard myself as a teacher, which is kind of weird because you're just constantly doing it and that's just your persona. But when I'm at home, and as a parent, I almost have, I kind of feel that role switch on. Does that make, it's like, you know, like a good footballer, he doesn't think, he just does. But when he's like, then you ask him to cook you a meal and he's like, oh, I don't know, I haven't got my chef here or something.
If you ask a good footballer, I was seeing loads of good sports people that try to become coaches or teachers and everything, they can fail because they don't have that patience, right? They don't have that understanding for the person as they try and learn, right?
Yeah, I think that's, and I suppose that comes back to what I was saying earlier. Yeah, patience. It's all about patience, isn't it? Yeah.
It sounds like you've had a lot of practice with the work stuff as well, so it's become a little bit auto, you go on autopilot in those situations a little bit more, so you don't feel like you're aware that you're teaching, but if you ask people in the room, they're probably saying, yeah, we learn heaps of stuff from Dan.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well, because I've gone through a couple of jobs of late where I've had really good feedback, and I've had some feedback where people just weren't into what we were doing. But every time I go into a workshop, I always learn. Like, I always learn, and I'm constantly adjusting and trying to refine my craft as a facilitator, or as a teacher, or as a guide, or however you want to define it. So I was in a situation a couple of weeks ago where we were facilitating, and it was part of a bigger program. And the bigger program was all of the result of the bigger program. It was a futuring project. And it got to the end of the workshop, and I was so into myself because I knew, like, I felt like, smash and grab, I've got the information I needed. And I'm ready to move on. But I completely forgot about the people in the room. So as a facilitator, I kind of took people for granted because they only saw their part of the workshop as the project, and I saw the bigger picture, and I forgot that, and I hadn't met them where they were at. So as a facilitator and as a guide, I'd failed. And I don't think I would have learned anything unless I would have failed in that situation, because as a facilitator, something I've observed is that you have to constantly repeat things. You have to constantly bring people in. You have to remind them what you're doing, why you're doing it. Even write down, you have a break, you have to come back, you have to reflect, you have to tell them what they're into, because people don't like progressive disclosure. They want to know exactly what's in front of them. They want to know what their day looks like. I mean, we did give them their day, but like they want to know every micro detail, what things are going, where they're leading to. And I always find there's a tension, which I've never worked out. I've gone on a bit of a tangent here, so sorry. I've never worked out that tension between trying to get rid of any kind of confirmation bias that will ruin an activity that's the multi-part thing, and progressively disclose things. So I'm constantly learning as a teacher and as a guide, like, what's enough and how do I ensure the people that come on that journey feel like they're emotionally connected, that they're not just discarded at the end of a workshop because we've got what we needed off of them. So, yeah, it can be kind of hard, because coming back from that designer mindset as well, or a craftsman, you kind of like, once you've got what you need, you want to get on and solve it and get to the project. So there's always that kind of tension.
So you have your own business. You've obviously been a leader in certain circumstances in one of these projects and workshops. Do you see teaching as a skill that a leader must have?
Can you just repeat that last part of that question, Dave?
I'll rephrase it. Do you think being a good teacher is a good trait for a leader to have?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think you have to be a teacher to own a business. Like, you don't have to be a leader to own a business, because you could be a really good manager. But it all comes down to the type of business you want to run. You know, so I guess I kind of feel like there's a bit more heart in terms of what I do, because I really enjoy it, and I kind of feel like I regard the people that work with us as family. I don't regard them as workers or the workforce. They're part of, we're a team. I even feel uncomfortable with the mantle boss. I don't like using it. In fact, I shy away from it. You wouldn't even know it. I put one of the team to take that role so I can just sit there and listen. But I think it's just something that you naturally fall into, or I have anyway.
What one piece of advice would you give a new leader when it comes to being a teacher?
Listen, isn't it, really? I mean, listen without prejudice, listen without having feeling like compelled to give advice.
Yeah, I get it. Dan, so again, this is about the playlist and about leaders, and we asked them, what the song do you listen to kind of trigger your teaching mode? Was there anything that resonates when you listen to a song that reminds you of teaching?
Okay, so I have a playlist that I play in workshops. So I have songs and music that helps me work to create learning programs where I get into flow. But then I have a rule in our workshops that I play music that offends everybody. I don't want to offend one person. Everybody should be equally offended with our music. And a facilitator over in the States recommended this artist they play in their workshops. And the guy is called Bert Kaempfert. That's BERTKAEMPFERT. It's like all this swinging 60s jazz, weird jazz flutes and stuff like that. And it just kind of, it gets everybody in a good mood. So in terms of the actual practical application, I will be playing it. I've got my little boom, UE boom for tomorrow. So I've got my swinging 60s, you can see there's a lady on the front. She's got like some sort of safari outfit on and she's doing a bit of a swinging of her hips. You can see what sort of music is. Completely ridiculous. That's when I'm teaching, because I want to set the right mood, because I believe people will learn when they're entertained, and they will learn when they're engaged, not when they're like just trying to consume things. I don't think learning is that binary. I think people have to be enjoying it, have a smile on their face. But in terms of when designing or when creating a workshop or a product a learning product, it's always something like pretty crazy, actually, something all over the place. Things like Orbital or Jimi Hendrix, Band of Gypsies is one. I always get deep into like Miles Davis, Bitches Brew, just stuff that's all over the place. It feels like there's no structure to it, but there is structure if you go down however many music levels deep or the beats deep. You can hear the structure beneath it, but on top of it, there's all this craziness, and it's almost like my brain hits onto the beats and I just kind of get enveloped into this crazy sound. So, yeah.
I'm similar when I'm working, trying to put stuff together. I listen to weird stuff like, Pink Floyd Metal, that album, which is very weird, or Animals or something like that, just weird stuff. But I like your suggestion of the music you play in a classroom being stuff that's going to offend everybody, because I have tried playing music in a classroom before and nothing I've played has ever, people have complained about it. So I just gave up after a while. So, yeah, I do like a couple of the games that I play, if it's like they got to make planes, paper planes and stuff, and I play airport music. Like there's a thing on YouTube with like half an hour of airport music. I play that. The Kanban pizza game, when they're playing, making pizza, I play Italian restaurant music.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
Kind of create the mood.
Yeah, I like that with the pizza. So we got an aeroplane game that we've adapted from a chap called Daniel Steelman. He's got an aeroplane game, and I never thought of playing that, because there's nothing worse than when people are doing like creation and design and everyone's silent. And it's just because a lot of our workshops, people are silent because they're thinking or they're creating.
Yeah.
So I like to put something on. But my rule of thumb is never be cool. Don't try and put on something cool.
I don't have anything cool on my phone.
You know, like some sort of like Kreuter and Dorfmeister or something. Ivory Corporation or something that you want to listen to. Don't put anything on that you like, basically.
Yeah.
Just something that people will kind of shift them and get them in a completely different headspace.
Yeah.
That's what you're trying to do.
Yeah. How about you, Dave? Do you have a teaching song?
Wow, I'm going to sound like a right wanker now. I was thinking about it today because I knew this question was going to come up. And it's called Wrapped Around Your Finger by the Police for a few reasons. Because Sting was a teacher before he became famous. And it's just the words around it that resonate with me. I said, I only came here seeking knowledge, things I could not learn in college. And it's all about that learning journey. But when I was researching to find out what it was actually about, it's actually a pretty spiteful song about someone turning the tables on someone that was being nasty to them. So I thought, interesting. And it's kind of then even resonated more with me and some of the teachers I've had over my life. So I was like, okay, that's a pretty good song then. It fits me.
Dave, do you play that in your workshop, that song?
No, I don't, that's not a workshop song, no. Well, I got to rub a few ideas from tonight's talk. All right, you ready, Dan? This is a quick fire round. Let's go. What book are you reading at the moment? You know I always ask you this question.
Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I've been reading it for over a year. It's killing me. I'm determined to get to the end of this book. I'm only 100 pages in.
Is it a big book or what's going on with that?
No, it's 280 pages. It's all, it's just pretty crazy. Well, it's not actually. It's all about systems thinking and philosophy.
We can probably recommend a better book for systems thinking if it's that kind of taking that long to read it.
No, it's amazing though. It's amazing. It's really good. But it's really hard.
Okay.
I found it very deep, very dense to read. So
right.
I thoroughly, thoroughly recommend it. I'm really enjoying my read.
Cool. Okay. What is your favorite smell?
Onions. Love. Or roast dinner. Love roast dinner. The smell of roast dinner is just insane.
What about roasted onions?
Roasted onions as well. With roast dinner, roast potatoes. Amazing.
So you're talking about the full roast dinner, like the Yorkshire pudding, gravy, all things.
Just... I haven't had Yorkshire pudding since I just haven't had them here. Like even I haven't even seen frozen Yorkshire puddings. Maybe I'm not looking hard enough.
Yeah, I'm Irish, so we don't go for the Yorkshire pudding. But yeah, I've definitely seen them. They are in the supermarkets.
What would you have instead?
Well, I'm Irish. We just have four different types of potato, right? There's roasted, mashed, boiled.
Oh my God.
Chips, you know. We just
four meat. Different. Four potatoes.
Six veggies and like four of them will be potatoes, right? That's
how and then the gravy. Like, the gravy. Yeah, wicked. It's brilliant. Love roast dinner. Love it when you get home from work and you can smell a roast dinner. Or when you get home from somewhere there's a roast dinner on. Or even if you're cooking it and you got... Because I've been at home so sometimes I'll cook roast dinner just to smell it. It's just wicked. Walking through the door.
I have to move on that because you're making me hungry. Sorry. And I gotta start cooking. What TV show are you binging at the moment?
I'm almost at the end of it. It's called Mythic Quest on Apple TV. It's about... a startup has this online game called Mythic Quest, and it's just about a very dysfunctional office. It's like every other kind of dysfunctional office, except it's got the high quality value of an Apple TV show. But it's very funny.
All right.
As a kid, Dan, what was your favorite toy?
My first toy I ever got was a Stormtrooper from Star Wars, and I have one Stormtrooper. And I remember when I got this question, that's the first thing I thought of. I remember sitting with my one Stormtrooper. I can't remember if I've lost the little rifle, the blaster that came with me. I just used to play with this one Stormtrooper. I don't have it anymore. I gave it away. Gave it away when I left England. Aww. Should have kept it.
It wouldn't have taken up much room.
None. I just got rid of all my Star Wars toys from when I was a kid. My kids just persecute me. If there's anyone listening out here that's young and has heaps of figures, like, this is the piece of advice I can give you. Or if you're like in your 18s, your teenage years, or you're just coming back from uni and you found this box of toys and you're just kind of like, I don't want this anymore. I'm going to give this to Johnny or Sally from next door because they're young enough. Keep it, because your kids will persecute you when they're older and they ask you what toys you have and why you haven't got them and why they can't have them. So just keep them. Put them in a bag. Put them in a loft. That's there you go. There's a bit of gold for you there.
So I'll let you into a secret, Dan. Anita, my wife, kept all her My Little Ponies from when she was a little girl and passed them on to my daughter, who loves My Little Ponies. So last question, since I messed it up. See, Dan got me hungry when we started talking about roast dinners and gravy and stuff. At the end of the world is coming, what is the last thing you do?
Eat your roast dinner.
Watching the last episode of Mythic Quest.
I thought I was going to read the last page of that book so you'd definitely finish it.
I'll take that last one. I'm just going to the toilet. I'll be out in a couple of hours when I finish my book. I can't say something serious now. Renee's laughing. I guess I'd show gratitude. I'd show gratitude for everything that I have earned. Everything that is in my life right now, and just like be blessed being in Australia, having an amazing wife and kids, and being so lucky with my family, my brother and his family and my wife's family and her side kids and all my friends and where I am, and just show gratitude for where I am.